Thanks for downloading the latest Rear Vision podcast. I'm Keri Phillips. What do you do with the remains of the world's worst nuclear disaster? First buried under concrete, the radioactive remains at Chernobyl are now behind a massive steel shield. What happens next?
The arch shielding the radioactive waste caused by the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear power station accident has started sliding into place. This was reported by Minister of Ecology and Natural Resources of Ukraine, Ostap Semerak. 165 meters long and 11 meters high, the construction is the biggest ground movable design in the world. The weight is more than 36,000 tons. The object was built in a spotless territory close to reactor 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant and will be slid more than 327 meters to close the unit.
That's a reporter from a Ukrainian English language news agency describing the mammoth steel arch that was installed last November over the remains of the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl, which lost its roof in a catastrophic explosion just over 30 years ago. In April 1986, the reactor melted down, exploded, and burned, sending deadly clouds of radioactive material into the atmosphere and across Europe. The shield is designed to prevent further leakage while the site is decontaminated, a job that will take more than a century to complete. One of the people involved in this international project is Professor Neil Hyatt from the University of Sheffield. How did the accident happen in the first place?
So the accident was a catastrophic failure and explosion and then meltdown of reactor unit 4 on the Chernobyl site. And there were three reasons for that. So the reactor design itself was flawed inherently. There was human error and there was also an inadequate safety culture. To explain a bit about the accident, I will describe a little bit about the reactors. The site had four operating nuclear reactors, and they were of a type called RBMK-1000, and they were designed in the Cold War and only operated in the Soviet Union and their satellite states. So on the evening of 25th of April 1986, the reactors started to prepare for a reactor test on Unit 4, and the test required the power output of the reactor to be reduced, but the test was then delayed due to an outage on the power grid, and the Chernobyl reactor was requested to keep generating. So by the time the test had started, which was in the early hours of the 26th of April 1986, the reactor was in an unstable state as a result of being operated at low power. And so to proceed with the test, the automatic shutdown mechanisms were disabled, and the control rods used to shut down in the reactor in an emergency were fully removed from the core. So during the test, when the power output started rising rapidly, the operators then tried to shut down the reactor by reinserting the control rods that they'd withdrawn. And the control rods in this particular design were tipped with a material called graphite. And graphite actually accelerates the nuclear reaction occurring in the core. So as the control rods were inserted and pushed into the core, there was an uncontrollable power surge. And this caused the fuel assemblies to rupture, a steam explosion in the water coolant, and this destroyed the reactor building, blew off the reactor lid, which weighs more than 1,000 tons, and then we had the resulting widespread contamination. So it was a combination of all three factors, really: flawed reactor design, human error, and an inadequate safety culture.
When the accident occurred, how did the people working on the site, how did they react and what happened?
In the immediate aftermath, the attention was focused on extinguishing the fire within the core and stemming the release of radioactive particles. The fire was initially fought using water, using handheld hoses. And in the following days, some 5,000 tons of sand, clay, boron and lead were dropped into the exposed reactor again to try and limit the radioactive release. So there were two immediate fatalities as a result of the accident, and then a further 28 deaths over the following months, arising from acute radiation sickness from those involved in the immediate emergency response. So as you can imagine, it must have been a terrifying situation. Lots of people trying to understand what was happening and how to respond to it. And one of the things that we learnt from the Chernobyl accident was the need to have very clear plans for emergency response, both on site and off-site.
So they obviously didn't have either of those there then?
Yes, so the evidence is that it was ill-prepared for in terms of this catastrophic accident. And if you read the first-hand accounts, it was clear that they didn't have the appropriate radiation detection equipment, or it was unobtainable or locked away. And there was no clear on-site management structure to respond immediately to that incident.
The Soviet Union has admitted there's been an accident at one of its nuclear power stations. But, as is usual when disasters occur inside Russia, there's been relatively little information about what happened or why or how serious it might have been.
A wave of radiation swept over the Scandinavian countries, with Finland detecting it first at levels 10 times higher than normal. Then a nuclear power station north of Stockholm evacuated about 50 of its workers. Scientists there had picked up an alarming increase in radiation levels and assumed it must be a leak in their own equipment.
What happened to the people who lived nearby? How was the situation managed?
So the evacuation of Pripyat, which is the nearest town to the Chernobyl site, which was the home of many of the site workers, there were 45,000 residents of Pripyat. The evacuation started only 24 hours after the incident. So that was when the first notification was issued to the local population, 24 hours later, and then the evacuation started. And eventually, over the following months, within a 30-kilometer zone around the destroyed reactor, 100,000 people were evacuated and relocated. In terms of the radiological impact of the accident on the environment, it's estimated that about 5% of the radioactive material within the reactor was released during the accident. And this resulted in heavy contamination of over 4,500 square kilometres in Ukraine and Belarus. And this was most evident in terms of early indications in what's now called the Red Forest. So this was a pine forest adjacent to the Chernobyl site. And the radioactive fallout caused those trees to die. And as a result of that, the green pine needles turned red. And that resulting contamination then spread across Russia, Scandinavia, Western Europe, including here in the UK, albeit at much lower levels. And the effects of that are still felt today. So there are still farms in Britain which are restricted in the way that they can use land and rear animals because of the radioactive fallout from Chernobyl, even though that was 30 years ago. In terms then of deaths attributable to Chernobyl, this is an area which is the subject of contentious debate, and there are considerable uncertainties because we're not certain of what happened to all the individuals, where they moved to when they were relocated, and it's very difficult to disentangle other effects on health from specifically the impacts of this particular incident. So to reliably attribute, for example, cancer deaths to this specific cause. So the World Health Organization has estimated up to 4,000 deaths attributable to the consequences of Chernobyl. And the environment within the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which covers about 2,600 square kilometers, remains heavily contaminated to this day, and access and inhabitation are restricted. And in total, we think more than 350,000 people have been relocated as a result of that accident. And then in terms of the economic consequences, up to 7% of Ukraine's annual gross domestic product is used to address Chernobyl-related issues. And that's clearly detrimental to the economic prosperity of the country.
Chernobyl is about 90 kilometres north of Kiev, close to the border with Belarus. Today it's essentially a ghost town, as is Pripyat, the larger city built to house the power plant workers. Paul Hill Gibbons is a photographer fascinated by abandoned buildings. He's visited Chernobyl several times.
I first went in 2007, and that was on a day trip, and that was both fascinating and frustrating. Obviously, we're quite limited time-wise. Our every move was watched by a government guide that had to accompany us. So we drove past a lot of buildings I would have loved to have looked in and couldn't.
Was it difficult to gain access to the site on that occasion? How did you actually undertake it?
In 2007, it wasn't that difficult because there were tours running then. When I went back in 2010, the situation had changed a little bit. one of the government departments, having charged a fee to access the zone, was making rather a lot of money, and that wasn't going back to central government, I think. So 2010, 2011, they'd actually closed it to tourists, so I had to go as a journalist. In 2010, I went for 4 days, and it was rather more relaxed, I'd say. We were let off the leash for 2 hours, provided we were back at this point at a set time. So, yeah, there was a lot more freedom. I enjoyed it a lot more.
Is it dangerous going there?
It could be, but probably not due to the radiation. Obviously, the level of radiation, background radiation there is raised, but it's not unhealthily so, provided you're not there for a long period of time. There are various hotspots that you wouldn't want to spend a great deal of time in. But the biggest danger is actually the buildings themselves, having been empty now for nearly sort of 35 years and about 25 years when I went, they are suffering and some are starting to collapse.
So there's been no attempt to maintain any of the buildings in the area?
Not in Pripyat itself. Some of them, there's a laundry actually that still functions in Pripyat. So obviously, I presume they're looking after that. But the vast majority of buildings have just been left to decay.
What were your impressions of what you saw? What did it feel like being there?
It was quite mixed. Obviously, it was quite thrilling and exhilarating to be there. But it's, on the other hand, there's the human element. There's the tragedy of just how people were forcibly moved from their homes on such a large scale. And obviously, the events of the night, you know, how many people suffered the consequences and were exposed to such high levels of radiation that it's quite poignant.
Can you tell us about some of the buildings that you photographed and what they're like?
There's obviously the centre of Pripyat. You've got the town square, which has a supermarket off it, and the Palace of Culture, which is quite striking, the main hotel. One of the places I found most fascinating was the hospital, because you know that's where those first responders to the accident were taken. And indeed, the hospital basement is one of the hotspots, because that is where those firefighters' clothes were stored. And because it's an enclosed space, the radiation hasn't dissipated. And it's still, 30 years later, kicking out dangerously high levels of radiation. And so it just brings it home, just the levels of radiation those firefighters were exposed to. And you know that some of those died soon after that, and many of them have died since from the effects. So it's a scary place. When a fire alarm goes off, you're very conscious of the reactions of others. Our guide, for instance, was very casual about most places, but Pripyat Cemetery, because unlike most places where they were decontaminated, obviously it's quite hard to remove the topsoil from a cemetery and keep the cemetery, so they didn't. And as a consequence, the background radiation is far higher there. And our guide, normally he'd get out, have several cigarettes, wander around. He got out for one cigarette and got back in the van. And we had a very set time limit there because of the higher levels of radiation. And again, when you know there's those higher levels, it focuses the mind.
Did you have to wear protective clothing or any kind of protection from radiation?
No, I didn't. If I'd have wanted to go in the hospital basement, I would have wanted some kind of hazmat suit and the right filters, but I didn't have those, so I chose not to. Otherwise, it's just use your common sense. If you're on hard standing concrete roads, etc., generally it's safer than being in the undergrowth, just because the weather washes it down and there's less radiation. Things like moss, patches of moss, you wanted to avoid those just because they absorb much higher levels of radiation than the area around them. So you wanted to avoid standing on those.
You photographed and spoke to people who'd been resettled. In fact, some were allowed to go back, apparently, or were now living in the area, possibly even illegally.
Yes, there's a number of resettlers that have returned to the zone. One of them that I actually met was Maria Europa. And she was in her early 80s. And from her village, she was one of 16 who had returned. She was relocated in 1990 to a larger city. But she returned because it's her home, and that's where she wanted to be. If the alternative is the 10th floor of a tower block when you've lived in a beautiful village, I can understand the desire to return and spend your last years there.
What's life like for the people who've come back? And in fact, are they there illegally?
Hard, I'd say. The village has a phone and it has electricity, but there's no running water. They are there illegally, but in 2012, they were given unofficial permission to remain, the elderly, that is. And most of them are elderly now. They're all in their 70s or 80s. And 80% of those that have returned to the zone are women, I think, just on the basis that they've outlived the men.
How are they managing to cope with that kind of life?
I think they're relatively self-sufficient, presumably a case of having to be. Maria showed us around her yard and she had a cow that she regularly milked. She had some vegetables growing out the back, and that's how you get by out there. We spoke to Maria and her husband shuffled out. It took him a long time to get out the front door. He shook hands with us all and then retreated back to his bed. And as he turned to go, you could see he was wearing about 3 pairs of trousers. But as he turned to go, there was a hole in his trousers and you could see his skin through all 3 layers. So it's a tough existence. And that remained with me, just how hard it must be. But it's their choice. And I think I can fully understand that.
Paul Hill Gibbons, and there's a link to his photographs on the Rear Vision website. This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on Radio National, RN, online, on the ABC Radio app and by podcast. If you are listening to a podcast, don't forget to rate us or leave a comment where you get your podcasts. Someone else with an interest in Chernobyl is former LA Times reporter Mary Maisio, who first visited the area in 1996 to write a story on the 10th anniversary of the accident. Her subsequent book, Wormwood Forest, A Natural History of Chernobyl, covered the effects of the accident on plants and animals. She discovered that 20 years later, the Zone of Alienation had become Europe's largest wildlife sanctuary.
I discovered that the zone around Chernobyl is a complete ecosystem with all of Eurasian wildlife present, including endangered species, that has become an accidental wildlife refuge because of the absence of people. My book was an exploration of radioactive nature. How does radiation move through the ecosystem? So how does it work in, you know, aquatic systems and lakes and streams and rivers? How does it behave in large mammals versus mice? How is a moose different than a mouse? So those sort of practical applications of radiobiology in what I hope to be a kind of engaging field trip.
Can you tell us what you did discover about the animals living in the zone?
They're healthy. There are more animals living in the zone than outside of it. The diversity of species is greater in the zone than outside of it. The greatest danger to the animals in the zone is not radiation, it's poaching. There's poachers who will, for example, there is a herd, there are actually now several herds, wild Przewalski horses, which are a species of horse that went extinct in the wild in the 1960s and has survived only in zoos since then. That program has been so successful internationally that there is actually no more room in captivity to breed these horses. And one of the largest breeding programs was in what is now Ukraine. And they did an experiment to see how the horses would do in the Chernobyl zone, because it's really one of the only places they would be safe because there's no people. And those horses have done extremely well. And now, at this point in time, there should be several hundred of them, but there are not because of poaching. And probably the poaching is people who work in the zone who poach the animals and probably sell the meat for sausage. And nobody knows.
Could you give us some idea of the range of animals that now live in the exclusion zone?
I'll give you the list of charismatic megafauna, as they say. We have foxes, wolves, raccoon dogs, roe deer, elk, moose, lynx. The Przewalski horses, despite the poaching, are still doing very well. And in a very, very strange development. They have gone from being a grassland species to a woodland species, probably to escape the poachers. Belarus introduced bison, Eurasian bison, and the bears. There have not been many bears, but there are bears there now, brown bears.
And what about the flora? Has that been badly damaged by radiation or indeed changed?
Not at all, no. In the beginning, yes. In the beginning, there was visible damage, especially in places where the radioactive ash from the explosion settled on the greenery. So in the early years, yeah, you definitely, I mean, there were places where you saw kind of deformations, large leaves, and there was strange stuff, things going on. But now, no. Now it looks perfectly normal.
Shortly after the accident at Chernobyl, the ruined reactor was buried under a concrete sarcophagus.
In the immediate aftermath of the Chernobyl accident, a temporary shelter was constructed to cover the partially destroyed reactor building. That was to contain, obviously, the radioactive debris and to reduce radioactive emissions, particularly particulates from the destroyed reactor. And I think construction on that started in June, immediately following the incident in April 1986, and was completed by the end of November. Now, that construction was clearly put up under emergency conditions, and so there are concerns about its long-term structural stability. It wasn't meant to be a sustainable solution to managing the Chernobyl site. So in the intervening decades, a new confinement has been designed called the New Safe Confinement. So this is an international project, and it consists essentially of a very large steel arch built in two sections to one side of the sarcophagus to reduce the radiation exposure to the workers. And it was moved into place at the end of November 2016, so 30 years after the original sarcophagus was completed. And it now covers that sarcophagus, or object shelter as it's known. And the new safe confinement, this steel arch, will enable the sarcophagus to be dismantled and the radioactive contents to be packaged, ultimately to be disposed of, and in particular, the product of the meltdown of the nuclear core, which is essentially a radioactive lava. This is a project we're helping to support here at Sheffield. So to give you an idea of the scale of the new safe confinement. So its height is just over 100 metres, so that's a little taller than Big Ben or the Statue of Liberty. And the covered length is 160 metres approximately, so the length of two football pitches. And it's designed with a lifetime of 100 years. So over the next 100 years, we expect to complete the final decommissioning project.
Is there any chance that it could blow up?
It's a question which we are very concerned with in managing the site. During the accident, the fuel inside the core reacted with its containment, its steel containment. It reacted with the concrete containment to form a highly radioactive glass, what we call lava. And then this melted and flowed into the basement regions of the reactor. So we still have nuclear material distributed through the reactor basement and compartments, and the shelter itself, the object shelter, the original shelter, was not watertight. So there were holes in the shelter, deliberately designed, and so rainwater was able to percolate through. We also used water inside the shelter to suppress the dust, radioactive dust. And as that water migrates through into the basement regions and comes into contact with the remnants of the nuclear fuel, there's a risk that the water and the fuel together can actually begin to sustain a nuclear reaction again. And there's evidence some years ago that, in fact, that did happen. So managing that situation and preventing a recurrence of what we would call a criticality, a nuclear chain reaction, is a very important focus of the work. What we can say is that the measures that are taken now mean that it's very unlikely that situation will reoccur. We have a much better understanding of this radioactive lava and where it's located. And we also have much better detection systems in place, so we can begin to react earlier if, in fact, you know, that situation was seen to arise.
How will the actual work of removing the radioactive remains be carried out? Will it be done by robots?
So much of it, yes, will be automated. So inside the new safe confinement, there's a system of cranes and robotic arms, which will be used to take apart piece by piece the sarcophagus and then recover and package the radioactive materials in drums or boxes to go for long-term storage awaiting disposal. And there's a mock-up, a scale mock-up facility, so that the operations can be tried and tested before they are applied in the real situation.
How can the operators of that equipment see what they're doing?
So you have to be incredibly skilled to be able to perform these remote functions. So there's a system of cameras, which themselves have to be, we would say, radiation hard, so they have to be resistant to the damage caused by the radioactive energetic particles that are coming from the destroyed reactor. And using the cameras, you can align your tools at the end of the manipulators in order to be able to perform your function. So to be able to lift a piece of cladding, for example, a piece of metal, or to undo bolts or to cut things. And so it'll all be performed by essentially closed circuit television.
How will it be removed from inside?
So the new safe confinement is essentially, we would say, it was hermetically sealed. So it means that no radioactive substances can get out. So it's sealed to the original building or the temporary building that was put up to cover the destroyed reactor. So inside the new safe confinement, these activities will take place, and the radioactive dust that's raised and debris and so on will all be contained. And there will be some measures, one would imagine, to suppress that radioactive dust, which is one of the primary hazards. So you can do that very simply by, for example, spraying water or spraying a plastic coating on a surface to keep that radioactive material in one place. So underneath this enormous arch, we will have this system of cranes with manipulators and robotic arms and crane systems to bring containers in and out. And very, very slowly over period of decades, we will gradually nibble away at the temporary structure and the radioactive materials contained inside, reduce them in size to fit inside the boxes. The lids will then be fitted and they'll go off to a storage facility which is contained within the new safe confinement itself to one side.
So it will remain ultimately on the site?
That's the plan for the interim, and one would imagine that that would continue for some decades. Eventually, the internationally accepted best method for dealing with radioactive waste is to bury it in a stable rock formation deep underground. So one would imagine that in many decades or perhaps a century's time, that waste will eventually be placed in an underground rock cavern, sealed with cement or clay, and that will be its final resting place.
Neil Hyatt, Professor of Nuclear Materials Chemistry at the University of Sheffield, one of the people involved in the International Decontamination Project at Chernobyl. We also heard Mary Mycio, the author of Wormwood Forest, A Natural History of Chernobyl, and photographer Paul Hill Gibbons. I've put a link to his website on the Rear Vision website. And if you're interested in seeing more, try Googling Tour Chernobyl. I found one that described itself as an eye-opening experience of a post-apocalyptic world, although I don't think I'll be taking it. This Rear Vision was mixed by Judy Rapley. Bye from Keri Phillips.